This Father's Day at Lowe's, score free gifts for the greatest dad. Right now, get a free Blackstone 8-piece accessory kit when you buy a Blackstone 28-inch griddle. Plus, get two free select Craftsman V20 tools when you buy an RP brushless drill and impact driver combo kit. Shop these deals and more this Father's Day at Lowe's. We help, you save. Valid through 6/15 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
Are you missing the sounds that matter most? What if you could hear every word, every laugh, and every moment crystal clear without spending thousands on expensive hearing aids? Introducing Audionatum, the world's most affordable FDA-approved hearing aid. With the revolutionary A2 chip, you get premium sound, zero background noise, and a 24-hour rechargeable battery. They even have Bluetooth connectivity to connect to your cell phone or TV. Unlike those traditional bulky $5,000 prescription hearing aids, the Audionatum is 90% smaller, 20 times cheaper, and works instantly. No visits to the audiologist needed. Audionatum has over 500,000 happy customers who have trusted Audionatum to restore their hearing. Our 100% money-back guarantee means zero risk to try. Don't like them? Simply return them and get your money back. They also come with a lifetime warranty. For the next 72 hours, the Audionatum is 53% off. Go to tryhearingaid.com right now to order your pair for only $99. Again, go to tryhearingaid.com to order your pair for only $99. Order now before it's too late, as these hearing aids have sold out over 10 times this year. With Audionatum, you can hear life again.
This podcast exists because of the paid subscribers at decodingtv.com. Become a paid subscriber, get ad-free episodes, early access to episodes, and bonus episodes. Thanks to everyone at decodingtv.com who makes this podcast possible.
Do you believe he made you heir because of your great wisdom, because of your virtue?
How dare you?
Or did he merely use you as a tool to put me in my place because he was afraid of me? Because he knew your legacy, unlike mine, would never outshine his own.
He was not afraid of you, Daemon! He could not trust you any more than I can trust you.
He was a fool. You sought greatness but shrank from spilling blood to achieve it, and I see you will suffer the same fate.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Cast of Kings, a podcast about the HBO original series House of the Dragon. I'm David Chen, and you know what they say, a child's head for a child's head makes the world go blind. Joining me today is Kim Renfro.
Hi. That's me. Sorry, I wasn't expecting that one, David Chen. That was a good, that was a really good phrase. That is what they say. You know what I say? I will clearly go to my grave, never knowing which one is Eric and which one is Eric.
And joining us also, you know her from her work on YouTube as Jesse Gender, Jesse Earl.
I'm actually not Jesse. I am my twin here to avenge my honor that was besmirched last week.
yeah, Jesse with two E's at the
yes,
end.
Yes, Jesse with two E's. It's spelled Jesse.
But pronounced not exactly Jack-y. The same.
No, pronounced exactly the same.
My parents hated me.
Anyway, welcome to our conversation this week about House of the Dragon, Season 2, Episode 2. You can find more episodes of this podcast at acastofkings.com. Email us. Let us know what you think of the show and the podcast at acastofkings@gmail.com. And you can support this podcast by becoming a paid member at decodingtv.com. Now, I want to mention, folks, we are recording this episode before the first episode of House of the Dragon has even aired. And so we're coming at you from the past. So, you know,
we're special like that.
Maybe massive cataclysmic things have happened in the world that we will not refer to. But the reason I bring it up is because one of the great things about this podcast is getting feedback from listeners writing into us at acastkings@gmail.com. And we love the feedback, and we love responding to it, but we haven't been able to respond to it because the shows haven't aired yet. However, our plan is to start shifting to a schedule after this week where we will be able to actually incorporate your reactions into the podcast. So just letting people know, that's why no listener feedback from the last episode, but in future episodes, you should expect to hear your own words quoted and reacted to here on A Cast of Kings. So write into us at acastofkings@gmail.com. Looking forward to hearing what people think about everything that's happening on the show.
I can give you feedback, David, if you want me to.
Yeah,
please.
I
can just give you feedback.
Yeah. Oh, I hear it from Jesse every week after the show, you know. You could do this better. You could do this. Anyway, love to hear it. castofkings@gmail.com. Really looking forward. Like, we're in this weird zone right now, honestly, where we have no idea what people's reactions are going to be to the first few episodes. But we're excited. It's an exciting time. So
I also thought you were going to warn them that we don't know what this episode is called because we're recording it in advance.
That is also true. We do not know the name of this episode. But by the time it's published, that information will be known. So the reason why we're artfully avoiding referencing the title is because they have not announced the title of this episode yet. So
we could just make up our own title, like Friends titles, like the one with the twins.
Exactly. Yes.
I like it.
Yeah. All right. So let's get into it. Season 2, episode 2. Title unknown as of now. Let's start with overall thoughts. Kim Renfro, what did you think of this episode?
I thought this was a very rich, like deep layered episode. Especially the second time I was watching it, I was like, ooh, this is really where we're getting all the payoff for everything that happened in season one and all of these like time jumps and like all of the history of these characters when they were younger, kind of all coming to roost. That's a phrase, right? Yes, it is.
Right? Nailed it.
Thank you.
Perfect. Yeah.
I thought it was amazing, especially this was directed by Claire Kilner, and she directed episodes 4 and 5 in season 1, which was notably like when Damon and Rhaenyra's relationship really took a turn into the sexual foray. And I think that you see that kind of come really full circle in the confrontation that we will get into later. Same with Claire Kilner also directed episode 9 of season 1, which was the entire episode where the Team Green was seeking out and trying to crown Aegon. And again, I think that there were, like, if you rewatch that episode and then watch this, like, there are so many really poignant dynamics between all the characters that I just thought were hitting so hard in this episode because of the performances, the writing. Yeah, I thought it was just a really good dose of hot D.
Beautifully said. Jesse Earle, any overall reactions to episode 2?
I have the same exact reaction. This is what I love Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon for, is, you know, just these long scenes of actors getting to act off of each other in really brilliant ways. And just you get to see all the different layers of the performance and the writing and just their relationships and the history that is built out of the books and everything. And so, you know, some people may consider this episode to be kind of a slow burn, not much happening in terms of like larger plot. But for me, this is just absolutely wonderful. Like, I adore all of this. Also, it gave me even more reasons to hate Kristen Cole, which is always a plus in my book. So A plus on that score as well.
If Kristen Cole has no haters, me and Jesse are dead.
Oh my God. Every single time he came on screen, I turned to my partner and said, oh my God, I hate this guy.
I think they're clearly setting him up as one of the villains of the show, at least, you know, like, I think they understand that he is widely hated, is my sense, right?
Yes.
It's like, if you thought Aegon was going to be the Joffrey of House of the Dragon, it's actually Kristen Cole.
It's actually somebody who on the surface seems much nicer and noble, but in fact is a huge piece of shit. So, I'll just say, I thought this was a very solid episode. And one of the things that I'm really appreciating about the season is no time jumps, right? Like, the episodes are picking up literal days or minutes after previous episodes. I'm curious how long they're going to continue that for, but it really gives these events room to breathe. It feels like these events that we're witnessing can have an impact, can reverberate in ways that feel organic. And as you both indicate, a lot of great acting. Just, you know, season one of Game of Thrones, one of the strongest things about it. Not the best production values, but had a lot of great acting, people in rooms just arguing with each other, talking about what's best for the future of the kingdom. And this episode delivers that in spades. So I had a good time with this one as well. Let's talk about what actually happened this episode. We'll divide things into Team Green and Team Black as we did last time. In Team Green, we open with a dramatic scene at the Red Keep after a servant discovers Jaehaerys' headless body in the middle of the night. The guards quickly round up everyone in the castle and imprison them while an investigation gets underway. We get reactions from Helaena's family. We see Aegon smashing up the stone model of Valyria that his father Viserys spent basically his whole life working on. And by whole life working on, we mean kind of designing. I don't think he actually built it himself, though, right? Like,
That's true. He gave the stonemasons credit, but he researched and designed everything.
I mean, this is the great man of history story. He did it all. It was all
him. He
was
the Elon Musk of this model, right? He didn't actually build it, but he had, it was his idea, pretty much, right? Anyway, we see Aemond returning to his room after a journey to a brothel and notices that someone has taken away all his coins from the map. It's unclear if he knows exactly what's happened at this point. Alicent is bereft over what's been done and seems especially torn up about the impact it will have on Helaena. But when she tries to tell Otto that the gods are punishing them, he brushes this off. There's a big scene at the small council. Aegon is raging at everyone. He's like, why didn't you stop this? Why didn't you stop this? But Larys curbs this outburst by breaking the news that they've caught Blood, one of the assassins that was responsible for killing Jaehaerys. So at that point, Otto concocts a plan for Jaehaerys' body to be publicly displayed in a funeral procession through King's Landing as a political ploy to spread hatred for Rhaenyra. And that's when we get the scene of Larys and Aegon torturing Blood while Helaena and Alicent put their grief on display in a funeral procession. All right, a lot of stuff in this opening segment. Kim, anything you want to point out about what's happened in the first part of this episode?
I mean, like you said, I love that we pick up immediately after. We obviously don't see the headless body of the child, but, we see the servant carrying, like, the bloody bedclothes, basically, out of the room. So it does a lot to just put the image in your mind of, like, what somebody must have done, or, like, what somebody must have discovered when they just walked into what they thought was, just checking in on our royal family here, and it's like, oh, God.
Love the Kim impressions.
There's a headless body here. I especially want to note that I think Tom Glencarney, who plays King Aegon, like, is crushing it in role this season. It's so good. We talked about this last episode a little bit, but like the layers that he's bringing to Aegon beyond just like, oh, I'm another crazy king, I think are great. And I found his grief and anger very believable in this scene. You feel for the guy here.
I agree. Like, he just brings such layers. Because, again, we talked, as you said, like, he could easily come off as a Joffrey clone and just very full of himself and, like, desiring pain and torture, especially in a scene like this. But he does just really give this great performance of grief mixed with just rage, because it's the only thing that he's known. And it's how he's been taught to be strong, right? A king, like, kills people and murders. Like, that's what he knows. And that's what he kind of has a lust for, because he feels impotent otherwise. But you do get this sense of just him wrestling with all of that and having legitimate grief underneath that he only knows how to express through anger. And it kind of gets at, we talked a lot about in season one, I mean, you two did, but like everyone generally talked about season one, about the patriarchy and how that hurts women and affects women and things like that. But I think his performance here is, I think, capturing the flip side of that, is how these roles for men and how, like, men are told to be strong and always have to express, like, anger and rage and violence. And that's the only way that they're told to be themselves. It is limiting to people, too. And I think, Aegon and Tom's performance really captured that pain as well in a really nuanced way. So he's just all the way until the end of this episode, I think he's been like the surprise MVP.
They've really done a good job of making that character complicated, making him sympathetic. It really does feel like they have changed direction on that character from the first season, when he was going to be more of a kind of one-dimensional bad figure, I think. One thing that was weird was Otto referring to Jaehaerys as his grandson, which is odd because technically Jaehaerys is Otto's great-grandson, is he not?
Yes.
Is this a thing in the Game of Thrones universe where they just call great-grandsons grandsons to keep it simple? Kim Renfro, is this a thing that's known? Does the term great-grandson exist?
I think
in Westeros?
It does. I feel like, yeah. I've heard, I feel like I've especially heard the reverse of people referring to their great grandfathers or like great grandsires if that's the George R. R. Martinification of it. I don't know, Jesse, do you recall any?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I've heard that before. People just go like, oh yeah, my grandson, instead of it being like, oh, my great-great-grandson and my great-grandson. Like, it's just simplifying it, you know?
Yeah, but I also think it's funny because it's like, he's like doubly his great-grandfather, because not only is Jaehaerys his great-grandson via Aegon, but Aegon and Helaena are siblings and are both, like, those are two of Otto's grandchildren who had his great-grandchild.
That's true. That's true. It's, yeah. And it's also, it also might be a way of Otto trying to, like, make his connection to the grief stronger. Like, it might be a political play, just a little subtle one, to be like, hey, he's my grandson, as opposed to great-grandson, which kind of provides some level of distance, at least on a rhetorical level. So there might be, like, a political, thinking going on there. And given what we see with Otto throughout this episode, that's certainly top of mind for everything he does, even in the midst of all this, like, violence and grief.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of political machinations, you gotta love a guy who, when his great-grandson has just been assassinated, he's like, but how can we use this to our advantage? And he certainly comes up with a plan to do that by blaming this horrific assassination on Rhaenyra, letting everyone see it, generating a lot of sympathy for Team Green, rightfully so, in this case. and we see this procession through the streets of King's Landing that's actually, in my opinion, quite beautifully done. The outfits, the way it's shot, and there's some slow motion, which is relatively rare in the Game of Thrones universe. It's a pretty brilliant ploy. There was a moment when he said, oh, we mustn't let the king suffer any, like, we gotta put the women out there, but we can't let the king do any of that. I'm curious what y'all thought of that. What'd you make of Otto's, like, hey, let's put Alicent and Helaena out there, but Aegon can't be out there. Like, that's not good. What did you think, Kim?
I mean, I think it goes to exactly what Jesse was just discussing, of like the way that within this patriarchal system that we're watching, men's emotions are, so, like, men's emotions that aren't anger or violence are certainly perceived as weak. And I think that Otto can clock in that moment that putting a, like, crying and bereft Aegon out for the small folk to see would actually be the thing that makes him seem weak, opposed to, like, it's fine for women to be seen as, you know, torn apart by their grief and a little bit undone. If anything, it's more politically advantageous to capitalize on a women's sensitivities, quote unquote, while hiding the fact that a man might be feeling a similar way. So yeah, exactly to what Jesse was saying, of when we talk about and make criticisms of patriarchal systems, which Westeros certainly is, and our current society certainly is, it's not simply saying, oh, this hurts women. It hurts everybody who's living under it. It hurts all factions of people, and men especially suffer in having their emotions sort of bottled up and suppressed, or told that they need to be expressed in a very specific type of way in order to be acceptable. I think
usually towards women in private, and usually violently too, which we also get little hints of in this episode too.
Exactly.
It reminds me a little bit of, there's this episode of The Sopranos where one of the mob bosses is at his daughter's wedding and is arrested at his daughter's wedding and starts crying. And it's extremely disqualifying that he is crying in this, you know, despite being like a very emotional situation. And it actually ends up creating, triggering some rather horrific, you know, incidents that occur as a result of it, you know. So it's like, yeah, there's this, it all comes down to toxic masculinity in the end. Jesse, any other thoughts on this whole sequence?
You know, I agree with everything Kim said. The other thing, too, and I think this ties throughout the episode, and we'll call it to it up, I'm sure, a couple more times, but the depiction of the small folk throughout the episode, I think, is really interesting. Just how much their opinion matters, and also how they're treated when all of these big things go down. Like, for example, at the beginning of the episode, we see them all being rounded up and sort of brought into the middle. which is kind of terrifying. I mean, if I was a small folk, I'd be like, I don't know what's going on. Am I about to be murdered for whatever reason? And certainly you can understand, like, hey, a murder just happened. We need to, like, gather everyone, see if we can, everyone just go here so we can make sure, keep an eye on anybody and anyone sneaking around we can capture. Like, it makes sense, but it would be terrifying. And then the same thing here, too, where they're doing the funeral procession and you just really clearly see how the public's perception of things is manipulated. Like, there you hear, even while we were seeing this grief, the, like, people standing out saying, like, oh, what, view the acts of Rhaenyra the Terrible or whatever it is. And it kind of very much feels like that, like, CNN, Fox News, like, let's constantly shove the same message at you all the time, sort of thing, and just sort of keep you in that echo chamber idea, and how that sort of manipulates the small folks' perception of these world-ending events that they really have no control over. So it's, yeah, it's an interesting depiction of the small folk that I really did enjoy, that oftentimes sometimes gets put aside for the more, like, oh, let's all focus on the great houses. So I really did enjoy that.
Yeah, because they're mostly cannon fodder through most of the show, right? They're mm-hmm. usually just, like, nameless people to be murdered.
A dragon swoops down
dragon
on somebody.
Just stomped on them, you know, like, yeah, whatever. And but here, it's their opinion really seems to matter. Mm-hmm. And you kind of see some of the consequences of the actions of people high up and how it trickles down. So that's cool to see. Cool to see. Any other thoughts on this opening sequence before we move on, folks?
Oh, or actually, shall we? One quick thing, too. I'll just keep it quick. But Allison's religion, her religious beliefs, I think just cropping up. It came up a little bit last episode, too, but here very much so. I like that as a recurring theme with her, about how she is very religious and yet views anything that happens through that lens and blames herself for, like, you know, cheating with Christian and all those things, or sleeping with Christian. I guess she's not really cheating technically anymore. I like that aspect of her character coming up. I think it feels very realistic for who she is.
She just desperately wants to unburden herself, but cannot find anyone to do that with. You know, mm-hmm, she clearly is living. She is living in sin. she has forsaken her purity vow. And it's going badly for
with
her.
With the worst guy. With the worst, like,
with
that's
literally
the thing
one
I can't
of the worst
forgive.
Humans imaginable. Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, the only other thing I'll say is it really got to me when they showed the Jaehaerys and his with his head stitched back on. I was like,
oh yeah,
somebody had to stitch that head back on, man.
Yeah, what a job. Yeah.
I was also like, that's a pretty clean wound for the sounds that we were
yeah.
hearing.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Like, I don't know.
Kim was admiring the craftsmanship of the killing blow.
Someone really put some really good work in there.
Right. Yeah. More like admiring the craftsmanship of whoever sewed it back on.
Yeah.
To cover up the sawing.
She was admiring both. She was admiring both the sawing and the reassembling, you know? So, yeah. Anyway,
oh, man,
nicely
that's
done.
Morbid, man.
Well, that's how I like to do it here on Guest Kings. So, anyway, all right. Well, those are some thoughts on the opening sequence of the show. Let's take a quick break for a sponsor. We'll be back with more House of the Dragon conversation right after this.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts. Like, last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
All right, Team Black. Rhaenyra gets a report. Boo! Rhaenyra gets a report about what happened and how she's being blamed for the cruelty. There is this moment when she realizes that Daemon did it. It's actually, you know, one of the criticism, this, as we're recording this, it's before the show has aired, but many reviews have already been published. And one of the criticisms that the show has received, very rightfully so, in my opinion, is that there's not much humor in the show, which is true. There's no like Tyrion Lannister-esque character. There's no Serio Farrell. Like, there's no one in the show that's kind of like brings the lightheartedness to the show. Having said that, I thought the scene was hilarious.
Oh my God, yeah.
The slow turn of the head.
Matt Smith is like, I've made a huge tiny mistake potential. You know, like he doesn't, he realizes like basically like she is going to learn about his actions. And he has an impish grin on his face when all this is all playing out. I mean, Kim, what was your reaction to this?
Yeah, just great, great Matt Smith faces throughout. But in this shot, I would say too, like, yeah, to speak to that, it seemed, and maybe this is like a nice Claire Kilner trick, but I think that we get some like amazing like reaction gif moments in mm-hmm. this scene. And that's certainly one of them. And it happens again later with Kristen Cole and Otto, where like I was cracking up about the faces and like slow yes. head turns yes. of like people reacting to things was just great in this.
Didn't call it out, I was about to, because that without getting too much, we'll get to that scene later, but there's a moment between Kristen and Otto where I'm just like, this guy, like Otto just, you know, is just going, this fucking guy.
Yeah. indeed. But this whole sequence is really well done, where Rhaenyra kind of uncovers exactly what went down. To this moment, I still don't think we have a clear sense of what orders Daemon gave to Blood and Cheese last week, right? Like, he says it was a mistake, but like, what exactly was said? Apparently he also said a son for a son. Essentially, you know, I'm going to put this out there, folks. A lot of the problems in the House of the Dragon universe would have been solved if people just put this stuff in an email. between Viserys's deathbed words and the orders that Daemon was giving to Blood and Cheese.
Where's like the public notary of King's Landing?
If people just wrote this shit down, none of this stuff would have happened.
You can't write your crimes down, though, David. We know that that's a problem.
Are you taking notes on a motherfucking conspiracy? I guess the idea is that he probably said, kill Aemond. It must be a son for a son. Also, if you can't find Aemond, it's okay to kill someone, right? Like, maybe he said something like that. We just don't know at this point in the show.
Right. And I'm like, when he keeps saying it was a mistake, is he thinking it was a mistake to even like to make this
right
to order this assassination, period? Or is he trying to say it was their mistake for killing a kid and like, or I can't control that?
Or third choice, is he saying I should have been a little bit clearer in my
right
wording?
Yeah, that was my read on it, because it was like him say he might have said a son for a son at some point in the second half of that conversation, meaning that he meant like a son for like we want to go after him,
right.
But they took it more generally, so yeah,
he's like, I was just riffing at that stage in the conversation when I said a son for a son, you know.
Yeah,
like,
I thought it sounded cool, might make it for a good title of an episode someday. Yeah, you know,
they should have taken me seriously but not literally is, you know, what he should have said. But anyway. And then I think, like, this scene also brings up that there's real doubts about Daemon's faith in Rhaenyra's abilities or her claim to the throne or her legitimacy, right? Like, that was my perception, is she has doubts that he believes in her. And I think he does nothing to really assuage those doubts. Was that your interpretation as well?
Yeah, I mean, I loved this scene. It was probably my favorite scene in the episode, because both of them are just giving their absolute best. And yeah, I agree. I think it's very clear, and I think Rhaenyra is very astute in this, in that he supports her, but only so much as that it benefits him. And she calls him out on it. And it showcases all of his decisions that he has made throughout the series. Like last episode, like, he did it for him. He did it because he thought it would help him. He groomed her. He groomed Rhaenyra from early childhood to get into this position. And yeah, he probably had other options at different points in his life, but he literally groomed her so he could have this option. And it's messed up. And I'm glad that Rhaenyra is smart enough to call him on it. And it just gives like her such wonderful agency in the episode. So,
Yeah, it really is effectively Rhaenyra confronting her abuser head on. Like, not just for the grooming of her childhood and, like, everything that, as I mentioned, we saw in season one with episodes 4 and 5, which were also directed by Claire Kilner, I think wonderfully, to the point that, like, you know, people are, like, actively shipping Daemon and Rhaenyra in the fandom. Like, people enjoy seeing these two characters together. They have a great chemistry. There's a lot of layers to the reasons why they ended up married and seemingly in a consensual way. But there's also this undercurrent of the fact that he was always a grown man while she was a child. And from the very first scene in the whole series between them, where he arrives back, he's just arrived back to King's Landing. He's sitting on the Iron Throne, you know, flouting all customs of the court, and, like, gifts her this necklace. And it's, like, this very, like, weird loaded scene where it's like, yeah, he's been setting up this dynamic because it gives, he believed it would give him control over her. But now that they're both adults and she is crowned queen, he's realizing that he doesn't have as much control. And he seems to try to enact it in ways that are very damaging to her, both politically, but also personally. Like, he's also, like, domestically abusing her now in their marriage. Like, we saw in the season one finale, he literally started, like, choking her, and she seemed terrified by the fact that he was, like, physically attacking her now in private on top of undermining her publicly. And there's, like, great moments in this scene where Emma Darcy's performance makes it clear that, like, Rhaenyra is still terrified of that possibility that, like, Daemon might physically hurt her when they are alone together again. And the way that she's flinching, the way that Rhaenyra flinches in response to things that Daemon does. And yeah, just incredible. Like, Emma Darcy's performance, I think that they bring such a depth to Rhaenyra that I wasn't expecting in this role. Like, Rhaenyra really feels like a lived person, and bringing all of the history of, like, the childhood of this character, even though Emma Darcy wasn't playing that version of the role, like, but you can tell that they've really, like, baked that into the background of what they're doing now in all of these scenes. Yeah. I just think it's incredible.
I agree. Really strong work from Emma Darcy and Matt Smith this episode. It turns out it's not a good idea to marry your uncle, folks. I mean, that's really the big message of this show. And I think we're starting to learn the full extent of why that is a mantra that you should adhere to.
House of the Dragon coming out with the hot takes. You know,
I know.
Don't marry your uncle. And this woke show, you know?
yeah. Hot D, more like hot takes about incest. Okay. Rhaenyra orders Baela to patrol on her dragon Moondancer. Baela notices the signs of damage from Daemon's raging, but Rhaenyra explains it away by saying he has to follow his own path. Daemon leaves on Caraxes to go to Harrenhal and try to raise support for Rhaenyra. Okay, remind me, Baela, I believe, is Daemon's child. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yes, with Laena, who is Corlys and Rhaenys' daughter, was, R.I.P. She died.
Right.
In childbirth while trying to birth their third child.
Right. And she got, like, incinerated by the dragon, right?
She was the original writer of Vhagar in this series. Mm-hmm. And it was only after she died. Basically, she chose, instead of dying in her bed in childbirth, she chose to go and have Vhagar Dracarys her in a sort of, like, suicide by dragon moment. It was super badass. Also, like, way preferable to having your husband order a C-section done against your consent and then dying in a bloody confusion. We hate Viserys.
since we're choosing from only the best options, right?
That's, like, true. Well, like, literally that option was presented to Daemon, not to give Daemon too much credit for things, but, like, Daemon was given the same choice that Viserys was, and didn't make it, and allowed Laena to go choose her own death. Anyways, we digress. So yes, Baela and Rhaena are Daemon's two daughters from that first marriage, in the same way that, you know, Rhaenyra had R.I.P. her three sons from her marriage to Laenor, even though they were really Sir Harwin's children. A lot of daddy issues cropping up in this episode.
Yeah.
It's great.
Speaking of daddy issues, there's a brief scene of Jace, who is Rhaenyra's kid, and Baela, who you just explained the lineage of. They're on a cliff. They're kind of talking briefly about their daddy issues and all the stuff they're going through. Just a nice little interlude.
And they're betrothed, in case you have forgotten.
And cousins.
Yeah. To each other. Betrothed to each other. Right?
Yes.
So, yeah. Wow. The show's really normalizing a lot of this, you know?
Mm-hmm. Don't marry your uncle, but cousin.
Cousins.
Oh, yeah. Cousins is like, that's basically, they're not related.
Not even related in this world.
That's okay. That's
it's the equivalent of complete strangers in this world.
Yeah.
All right. Back to Teen Green. We're at the Red Keep. Helena crosses paths with Aegon. He just walks away without saying anything. Not really the kind of sympathy that I think a husband should give to his wife in really challenging situation, but it is kind of what I expected. Like when they met each other, I said inwardly, I'm like, I bet he's just not going to say anything at all. And that's in fact exactly what happens. I don't think he really has a playbook to work from in this situation, right? Like people like Aegon, they don't really know how to process their emotions and communicate them in situations like this. So it's bad how he treats her, but at the same time, I also like understand how we ended up in this situation. Kim, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it goes back to exactly what we were talking about before with the damage the patriarchy does to young men. And I think particularly with Aegon, it's a little bit extra layered and maybe tragic that really all of the evidence that we have is that Alicent is kind of the one who has kneecapped him in this way a little bit. Like back in season one, a lot of her private interactions with him were just a lot of screaming, slapping, chastising, not properly processing, like, hey, you could be a better man and I'm going to help you get there. It was a lot of like, I'm going to try to force you into being the type of man that I think you should be as my son. And then like we see all of the ways that Aegon then just doesn't have the toolbox with which to be a seemingly like decent human to anyone, including his wife and sister.
Yeah.
Sister wife.
and it comes down to a lot of that, like going back to Alicent, that religious fundamentalism that she has too. Because in a lot of, like, again, this is not all religious households, so I'm not putting it in a bucket just to be clear, but like religious fundamentalism will often have very delineated gender roles and be like, the man is the head of the household. That is the way that, you know, God or gods in this case sort of assigned it. And so there's an element of that being sort of put here with Alicent having put that onto Aegon and Aegon now suffering the consequences of his inability to do that and then extending it to others, you know, hurt people, as they say. So
I watched this documentary about like some, I don't even remember what it was called, this sect of Christianity. Have you guys heard about the umbrella metaphor? The idea, the umbrella principle is that the idea that one man holds the umbrella faithfully and by God's grace and people are protected by the cover that it provides. So like man is the umbrella and then the woman is like underneath the umbrella. Anyway, my point is just to say this dynamic is still very much a thing that's actually present in planet Earth in our real world.
Thanks. I hate it.
You see that a lot too. And like, you know, I've seen that come up with like, and it kind of plays into the show too, with anti-LGBTQ stuff where you'll see an image of like man, woman, two kids, their 2.5 kids. And then their man's holding the umbrella, and then there's like a rainbow, a queer rainbow falling on them, and being protecting from the queers out there, like we're the deviants sort of thing. So yeah, that is very much present, and you can see it in the show too, with like how like they sort of like look down on queerness and all of that jazz has to be hidden throughout the show, as we saw in season one. So
yeah, there's a couple of scenes with Kristen Cole here. You know, he watches the servants clean up Jaehaerys's blood. And then also Alicent and him kind of have a chat where she wants to make sure he's not telling anyone about their affair together. And then she kind of gets in the bath. And this was a confusing scene for me. Like, I didn't understand. There was so much attention paid to Alicent getting in the bath. Like, it shows her disrobing very deliberately. And then she gets in the, and I was like, What is this? What is going? Can you help me understand what was going on here, Kim? What was your interpretation of this?
I thought it was twofold. One, this sort of like cleansing imagery, right? That like she's, as we said, like kind of seeking absolution or seeking to sort of offload her crimes at various stages. It's also like vaguely like suicidal ideation related feels like, with like the way that she like submerges herself under right. the water, as if she's like, you know, I would very much like to just leave this plane of earth. Yeah. But
that, that I got, that part I got, but I was just like, I didn't know, cause they usually don't show a process like that of like, it literally shows her like taking her clothes off. And yeah. I was like, they usually don't show some of that unless it's like
sex
leading to, sex or leading to something like, or like potentially like a subjective point of view. Like we're watching Kristen watching her take her clothes off and it's something lascivious about that, you know, but I didn't really, in the end of the day, didn't really, understand exactly. It was just like, oh, okay, and she's feeling depressed and so she gets in the bath. Like that's kind of what I ended up taking from it, you know.
I think that there's also they had a whole bath scene with her in the last episode as well, where she was sort of, she seemed to be almost like overly scrubbing herself, if I remember correctly, like after she sends away the servants that Laris hired for her. So I also think that they might be bringing back this like idea that she has a bit of like an OCD or like anxiety tick. Like throughout season one, the younger Allison particularly was constantly like chewing and kind of tearing up her nails. And it's almost like she learned not to do that habit anymore. But now like in the privacy of her room, like her disrobing and getting in her bath is kind of her like little anxiety stim that she does. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Yeah, no, that makes sense to me. It feels like, again, I like the your connection, Kim, to the cleaning yourself like spiritually and her like seeing herself as drowning in sin. I think you said that, David. So I think that kind of matches up there. And then also, yeah, the tick of it of being like, oh, this is how she handles her anxiety, is she does a lot of baths and cleans herself, which could, you know, could also be its own harm. Like you, if you overbathe yourself, it can harm your skin, you know, it can do a lot of different things. So I'm curious to see if that'll continue on, as that was an interesting aspect of season one with her character that I haven't really ever seen depicted well in shows. Like that was, you know, I have criticisms of season one, but that aspect of her character of having that sort of like nervous tick that was very self-harmy in a way, it felt very, very accurate to how it kind of appear in real life.
Shortly after this, Sir Criston takes out his guilt on Sir Eric by shaming him about his dirty white cloak, accusing him of sympathizing with Rhaenyra. Criston then orders him on a secret assassination mission to Dragonstone. Do you guys think Criston went into the room with the plan to like order him to the assassination plan, or did he just kind of improvise that in the moment? Because he starts like complaining. He's like, "Hey, your cloak is dirty. Go wash it." And then they get into this argument, and it's like, he's like, "Where were you?" You know, and they start getting this argument. And by the way, BT Dubs, you should assassinate Rhaenyra. You know, like, and it's like, really? Did he just improvise that? Or was that like extemporaneous, you know?
Okay.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
So the reason that I hate Criston so much, let me give you my TED talk here.
Reason number 237
is my read on him is he is just a man who, again, also can't process his emotions. And anytime he feels bad about something, he has to shove it out and blame someone else.
Yes.
So that he doesn't have to hold it on. It's like, I am pure.
Yes.
I am clean. It is someone else's fault and problem. So like in season one, it's like Rhaenyra besmirched his vows as a gold cloak. So it was Rhaenyra's fault. It wasn't his choices that led to that end. It was her fault because of that. And then here too, we have that scene where he goes in and we see like he sees what his failure to be on duty and sleeping with Alicent has wrought, which is the death of this child. Like if he had been there, he might have been able to save or stop this from happening. And he can't take that guilt. And so he just shoves it out on Sir Eric. It's like, it's your fault. You're besmirching the gold cloaks. You failed. And so my read on it, and again, it's open to interpretation, is like this may be a plan that he had thought of or at least had in the back of his like, oh, it might be interesting. But I don't think he intentionally came into the room to do that. He just sort of like saw the gold cloak and was like, he just had to like unload his feelings of guilt on something. And so he just did it on Eric. And then because it maybe was an idea in his head, he's like, all right, well, you know, if you want to be a man, you should do this. And it's really honest. Everything here that he is expressing to Eric is what he wants to do. He wants to go and kill Rhaenyra. He wants to like feel pure and clean and make sure his cloak is not like besmirched by whatever. It's like, it's all just shit that he's projecting onto Eric. And Eric sadly has to deal with the consequences of that.
Yeah. Well said. And yeah, I agree completely. he's somebody who is accusing everyone else of the stuff that he himself is doing, and those people are terrible to be around. So
I also found it super I found it super interesting that Eric is the one who brings up a very good point, which is like, why is Sir Criston, like, after last episode we talked about like, oh, how exactly was Sir Criston shirking his duties by having sex with Alicent in that room in that moment? And he is still the sworn protector to Alicent, but Sir Eric gets cut off, but he starts asking, like, why didn't Queen Helena have a sworn protector yet, now that she has ascended to being the queen? And again, it's a good reminder that, like, we aren't doing big time jumps right now. So in this universe, it's been, I'm guessing, like, several days, weeks, maybe max, since Viserys died, which then made, after crowning Aegon, it made Helena the queen of the Seven Kingdoms and Alicent Dowager Queen. But Eric calls out Sir Criston for not having yet changed up the hierarchy of the Kingsguard to assign a sworn protector to Helena, and instead has stuck with Alicent. And like, so even if he had been on duty, I don't think he would have been at Helena's room, is what Eric is saying. And that therefore Helena and her children were extra exposed to an attack like this.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I also have to say, this show did make me aware of like a really serious security flaw in these people's thing, which is, if you have two twins working on opposite sides, it's obviously a massive point of possible infiltration. So they really, but that's like number one piece of advice to people in Westeros: put it in an email, right? That's kind of my number one piece of advice. Second piece of advice: if you have twins working on opposite sides, you gotta do something to distinguish them. Like, brand them, like, you know,
give them shave one beard,
give them a tattoo of some kind, you know, like,
why not just a code, cut a ponytail. A code phrase, just use a code phrase, David. Jesus, going right to the branding.
I'm just saying clearly the stakes are high, as we learned this episode. Anyway,
also, like, maybe change your Kingsguard Queensguard armor, like.
Yeah, that was my thought too. I was like, is he still wearing the same damn thing? Yeah.
Right. Like, presumably, like, he still could have, like, stealth gone in and, like, gotten a new suit of armor or something. But the fact that they literally still have these same outfits on both of the Kingsguard / Queensguard, I thought was another big flaw.
Or, I'm going to put this out there, change your hairstyle. You know, once a month, mandated hairstyle change to a random style. You know, like,
trim and then a ponytail, like, bangs. Right.
Trim the ponytail, do a buzz cut, you know, like, and then it's like, there's no way he could possibly know that that's what the other Eric is sporting at that time, you know?
To briefly talk about another show, this is just the year of twins having the same haircut.
Exactly.
Yes. We're talking others.
The same thing is happening in the Acolyte. The Acolyte has twins that have the same hairstyle, which leads to some, I think you would agree, wacky hijinks.
Indeed.
So, anyway. we're just giving these ideas away for free. Like, the people of King's Landing can benefit from our guidance here.
Hire us as consultants.
Exactly. You know? Security consultants, for sure. All right. Anyway, those are some thoughts on what's happening over with Team Green this week. Let's take a break for a sponsor. We'll be back with more House of the Dragon right after this.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
All right, let's go back to Team... Oh, actually, no, there's some more Team Green stuff to talk about, right? We also see Aemond has been spending his nights at a pleasure house in King's Landing, drinking what appears to be milk of the poppy and bearing his soul to the brothel madam. This is an interesting scene. You know, we kind of get a little bit of Amund's tender side, a side that he doesn't show other people. Kim, what'd you make of this scene?
I thought this was a really interesting way to kind of get to the point of the plight of the small folk being of strong consequence to whatever their rulers are deciding, as we see often on very angry or vengeance driven whims. Also the fact that they decided to bring back this specific character of the quote brothel madam, that's just how she's quoted, or that's how she's identified, I believe, in the credits, at least in season one, which again, we saw this character in season one, episode 9, when Amund and Kristen were on the hunt for Aegon, and he was like, oh, let's go to this one brothel. My brother brought me here when I was a child and basically had me lose my virginity to her. And she recognized him, now all grown up. And it's like, oh, okay. He has now continued returning here in the weeks since that episode, the events of that episode transpired. And yeah, just a very, the way that he kind of curled up in the fetal position on her naked. Like, we don't see a lot of male nudity in that sort of tender way in Game of Thrones. It's usually either very violent or hyper-sexualized. And I just found this a very very interesting take on what Amund is going through and how he's processing not only his own actions, but what's happening with his family right now.
Yeah, as we discussed, one of the most interesting parts of this episode is the focus on the small folk. They, you know, the brothel madam, so to speak, makes it explicit when she's like, "Hey, the stuff that you do, it impacts people like me," you know, which is a little bit clunky, but it's it's making the point, and the point is made. Furthermore, as we cut to this guy named Hugh Hammer, is that the name of the character?
Yeah.
This is the same character we saw in last episode who was petitioning for an advance payment on some of the weapons that they're making for the wars to come. And we see his family struggling to put food on the table. I believe his wife is also somebody that we saw in the procession earlier, correct? If I recall correctly.
I think so, yeah. I think she was one of the faces that we saw in slow-mo. Yeah,
we saw a bunch of faces, and then it's that woman then shows up and is married to Hugh Hammer, and they have a child who's sick, and they're not sure if they're going to make it. Yeah, so it's rare that we see this kind of focus on these characters in the Game of Thrones universe, right? It's not that it hasn't been done before, but we don't really get this POV. I think my question, we'll probably talk about this in bonus episodes, I guess, but my question is, where is this going? Are we expected to invest in these characters? what's going on? Jesse, any reaction to that?
Yeah, I think the only thing to say really is he is definitely a character who exists in the book. And that's pretty, that is about really all you can say without spoiling too much.
All right. I appreciate the caution. Back to Team Black. There is a scene of Corlys's ship still being repaired as we check in with Alan of Hull and his brother. Another new character named Adam. I love how George R.R. Martin writes characters. It's basically just the same name as on Earth, except spelled slightly differently. So it's, Sir Kristen, but Sir is spelled with an E. And there is an Adam, but it's spelled A-D-D-A-M. So,
and even Alan isn't A-L-A-N. It's A-L-Y-N.
That's how you know this is fantasy.
That's how you know it's a fantasy world. Two D's.
Not the dragons. It's the two D's.
Two D's and Eric, the Adam.
Eric and Eric can be spelled two different ways with five letters. Who knew?
In the same family.
But they kind of talk a little bit about how Corlys owes Alan, and I don't know where any of this is going, but I anticipate we'll see how it plays out during the course of the season.
They are definitely in the book characters.
We see Corlys and Rhaenys in bed together discussing Daemon's fickle nature and his loyalty to Rhaenyra or lack thereof. And then Rhaenyra has a conversation with Missaria where at first she seems pretty unreceptive to letting Missaria go because apparently Daemon made a deal with Missaria, give me this information and then I'm going to let you go. And then he just kind of pieces out before he fulfills his part of the deal. Not cool, Damon. Not cool. But eventually, Rhaenyra kind of agrees to the deal, right? She's like, hey, I will honor my brother's word. And as a result of that good deed, Missaria ends up warning Eric about the arrival of his brother, which saves Rhaenyra's life. So, hey, one good turn deserves another. Let's see. There is a scene of Adam of Hull seeing a dragon flying overhead while he's collecting rocks. I have to say, this is a very confusing scene. I didn't understand like what we were supposed to take away. Like, are we supposed to be focusing on the rocks? Are we supposed to be focusing on the dragon? Like, what was going on? Where are we even? Jesse, help me.
This, again, I have to be very careful with my words here, because this is something that I was watching this, and this is a scene that for book readers, you're like, oh, I see what they're doing here. Mm. For every other person who is not a book reader, this scene is just weird and serves no point whatsoever and is just kind of there. So yeah, it kind of reminds me of last week's episode with the whole bit with, again, the sun for sun thing. We talked about this in a bonus episode, so I won't go too into spoilers, but like there's a moment in the baby choosing scene at the end of last week's episode that is clearly meant to like draw parallels to the book, but for everyone else who has not read the book, it felt weird, as you expressed last week, David, and this scene too, where it's, yes, like, again, I don't want to overreach and spoil anything, but this is, every book reader saw this scene probably and was like, I know. But everyone else is sort of like, okay, cool. There's rocks and a dragon. I'm glad. Good, yeah, for you, show.
It's a moment where I'm like, I wonder what the writers, this episode was written by Sarah Hess, who's one of like the main co-producers along with Ryan Condal, the showrunner. And it's one of those times where I'm like, what do they think the recappers are going to do with this scene in terms of like going into detail? I feel like it's fair to say that we can identify the dragon as sea smoke, because again, like they've been pretty distinct with all the different coloring of the dragons and where
and
they
sea
are.
Sea smoke belongs to which side, just to be clear?
So sea smoke was Laenor's dragon. Laenor being the believed dead ex-husband of Rhaenyra. Remember, she helped fake his death in season one, and he just escaped across the narrow sea with his lover, Carl, leaving his dragon behind. Mm. So sea smoke is a riderless dragon, and as Damon recapped for us in the season one finale, there are a number of riderless dragons currently out and about in both Dragonstone and Driftmark, all of which currently belong to Team Green. Or sorry, Team Black. So yes, that was a Team Black riderless dragon in the skies as Adam of Hull collected some rocks on a beach. Which, like, I found it, to me, my best, like, spoiler-free explanation is I found it like another kind of link to what we saw in the first episode of this season when Rhaenyra was searching for Luke's body and like seeing the perspective of the dragons through the eyes of sort of these more common people, and how it's kind of like seeing a war bomber flying overhead and being like, oh, mm-hmm, like, mm, wonder if that's gonna kill me, or like, wonder if, you know, maybe I can get behind the wheel of one of those one day, like, type of attitude.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Well, yeah, I can confirm that when I watched the scene, I was completely baffled by it. And I actually rewound it a couple times to be like, did I miss it? Like, what is even happening here? But it's just Adam of Hull, a character we just met, collecting rocks, and then a riderless dragon flying overhead. That's yeah, literally, yeah, what the significance is.
Yeah. As book readers will find it very cool. Everyone else, no idea.
Okay. Well, maybe we could talk about it in the bonus episode. But let's talk about what happens at the end of this episode for Team Black. Rhaenyra is in her room getting ready for bed as Eric, with an A, tries to carry out his assassination mission. Eric, with an E, bursts into the room at the last minute, having been warned by Missaria, saving his queen as he fights his twin brother to the death. Let me just say, folks, I was so happy that there was no stupid subplot of Eric replaces Eric and like it's going to be a comedy of errors for like two episodes long if we need to deal with like, oh, they don't know that Eric is actually Eric. One thing that I am really been happy with so far is this show will introduce a plot thread. Hey, let's kill Aemond. And then by the end of the episode, it will have carried that out. And in this episode, it's, hey, let's, Eric is going to infiltrate Rhaenyra's castle. And then by the end of the episode, that's it's the thing is done and dusted. And I appreciate that the show does that. So we don't need to like wait forever and possibly have some kind of Parent Trap-esque situation of the twins, you know, replacing each other or whatever. And it's unknown who's Eric and who's Eric. I will say it was a little confusing, like when, you know, one of the Rhaenyra's other guards comes in and is like, I need, you know, kill the guy, kill Eric. And it's like, who, you know, which one is the bad one? And you can appreciate that that would be a very difficult job. But overall, pretty effective scene. Any other thoughts on the scene? I do have a comment on the very ending of the scene, but I'm curious, like, yeah, Jesse, any reaction to how this all played out?
No, I alluded to this last episode when we were talking about the Erics. I didn't realize we were going to get this fight sequence so soon. But this was, I liked this sequence in the book. It comes across as much more poetic, I guess is the best way to put it. I mean, it seems like the very clear intention that Martin was going with these clear characters in the book is to be like, oh, it's brother fighting brother. It's a civil war. Like this is two sides fighting each other. Hence why like their names are both the same. It's a little on the nose being like, hey, they both the same, but they're both fighting each other. It's how the nation tore itself apart sort of thing. As Kim already put in some of our notes here, this was also part of the book of like the Kingsguard couldn't be told apart in the book, and they sort of died to get fighting each other in the book. And I really like that poetry of the book. I thought that was just a really cool moment. So I always like that. The only difference really is the suicide at the end there, which is not in the book. I guess is the best way to put it. I kind of like the other option in the book where it's just they die fighting each other and there's not like a clear distinguishment in the end of who is who. Whereas here we kind of, I mean, you could make an argument that it's either one, but more than likely it was the Eric who followed Rhaenyra who fell upon his sword at the end there.
Right. So. And the logic being, I'm sorry that my brother tried to kill you and I think I could not stop the attempt of the assassination. Like,
yeah, that and also probably feeling bad that his brother, that he killed his brother as well.
Right. Grief over having to kill his brother as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause it's like the two of them are effectively a miniature encapsulation of this entire civil war, which is that like kinslaying is particularly viewed as like an affront to the gods, and so like the fact that he like underneath his sworn oath to for both of them underneath their sworn oaths to protect the ruler of the kingdom that led them to killing one another, both like following orders but also doing the thing that you are absolutely never ever supposed to do, which is kill your own blood, let alone your own twin. And again, as Jesse was saying, like the added symbolism of the fact that the onlookers, aka like a stand-in for the small folk or everybody else, can't even really tell the difference between these two people. You know, like the show's gone out of its way to really split them into like Team Black and Team Green, but if you're just someone like out living your life in Westeros, like you probably haven't like memorized the family tree of House Targaryen, and it's just a bunch of Targaryens, all of these different descendants of Viserys and Velaryons and everything suddenly fighting one another. And yeah,
it's basically gotta be like the kingdom's like keeping up with the Kardashians, except for there's the added aspect of you might die involved. Yeah. It's like if the Kardashians had nuclear weapons.
And like one fight over a sandwich might mm-hmm. blow up
your village or
the
whatever,
entire San Fernando Valley.
So when you were watching this, could you figure out who was who? Like,
I thought I had it with the cut on the leg.
Right,
and
right,
then
right,
I
right.
lost it.
Right, 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 right. So like when Eric, when you're learning another language, you often don't know what the definition of a word is, but you can get it from the context, right? Like, mm-hmm. I figured it out from the context. So were you following who kills himself at the end, or did you just get it from the context? Because like from the context, it seems most likely that it's Eric that worked for Rhaenyra, like the Eric
right.
that's loyal to Rhaenyra.
Because he says, not, "Your Grace." He says,
right,
"I'm sorry,
it would not
your
make
grace.
Sense for somebody who hated that Rhaenyra, like who hated Rhaenyra, to then kill himself, right?" But I don't know. It feels possible to me.
I mean, you could read it that he's like, if it was yes. the Team Green, Eric. Yes. You could see him being like, oh, I'm confused about and conflicted about this whole thing. Like, yes. My job is to always defend the queen regardless. Yes. And since they're fighting each other, I feel bad. So maybe he even's like, I killed my brother. I was sent here to kill you. But now I realize that's just a fool's errand because this is just against my entire vow. And I just killed my brother, which is also against my vow. So I'm going to kill myself and acknowledge that she's at least some form of royal. Maybe not someone I would have stood up for, but some form of royal. So you could make the argument that it was the Team Green Eric as well that died by suicide there. I think it's more likely that Team Black one, but it could have been either. I think
I just think it's fascinating that it seems to me that they shot this in a way as to purposely make it confusing. That is the only conclusion I can come to, right?
Yeah, because I was tracking it with like the wound in the leg and like the fact that Eric with an A, Team Black Eric, clearly got the upper hand on Eric with an E there,
right?
And then I was like, oh no, Eric with an E just died. But then I was rewatching it and I was like, there literally is like a shot where all of a sudden I'm like, oh, I don't know what angle I'm watching that from
right.
quite right now. And like, maybe that was Eric with an E. So yeah, it seems to be the point.
You heard it, folks. Literally, in my opinion, one of the top Game of Thrones experts on this planet could not figure it out. Or at least could not definitively figure it out.
Lost brain cells, according to science, by just having a baby. So give me a break here.
And also, I think that's like part of the book. Like the book, as the book yeah, says, right. it's like they no one could tell them apart. So I mean, like I think it's intentionally like you're not supposed to know in the end.
Yeah, but then he gives that little speech and kills himself. So I'm like.
Which does not happen
in the book. So I'm like, does mm-hmm. the show want us to leave it open that it could have been either of them that did that? You know what I'm
yeah,
saying?
That was my big thing about right. the change of like, it feels like they want us to lean that way, but I think you can, and again, that's like, if they had given us a definitive answer there, I probably would have actually found that disappointing because I like the poetry of it a little bit more in the book. And I like that it's, at least it's a little bit enough that you could, again, make the argument that it's Team Green or Team Black. I think their intention was to say that it was the Team Black one that survived,
yeah,
but
yeah.
My own headcanon, I think there's still enough wiggle room that you could argue it either way.
I watched this South Korean horror film or horror series called All of Us Are Dead. Have you guys heard of this show?
No.
Brilliant show. And it takes place in a school. It's like this zombie invasion happens at this Korean school. And one of the things that I thought was so cool about it is all the kids at the school wear a uniform. But in the series, every single one has a distinctive look. So like one of the kids takes off his uniform, takes off his jacket. One of the kids has a head wound. So he has like a wrapping over his. So basically like you look at every single one. It's like, oh, that is, I know exactly who that is. Even though they all like come from a school where they all have the same uniform. So if the objective of the show is to create confusion about who is who, I think it succeeded. And I just think it's fun. I'm just kind of musing on like what their intention was. Like, did they want us to have a definitive answer for who that was at the end or not? I don't know. Let us know what you think at castofkings@gmail.com. Curious to hear. All right. Let's get to the final stuff that happens with Team Green this episode. There is a scene where back at King's Landing, we focus on the small folk. And as it becomes clear that Aegon ordered the execution of all the rat catchers who work in the Red Keep. This enrages Otto, triggering a fight where Aegon fires Otto and promotes Kristen to Hand of the King. Great sequence. again, you really sense Otto's frustration. You also know, man, Otto is not keeping his job at the end of this. You know, like, there's no way he can survive being this insolent to the king. But yeah, it's tense, man. I was worried for Otto's life during this conversation. I was like, is Aegon going to do something wild? Instead, he just gives Otto's job to Sir Criston Cole, possibly one of the least qualified people.
This fucking guy.
I understand fire.
Even Criston seems to understand.
Like, what you doing? I hate me. What are you talking about?
Me?
I just felt this entire sequence could be summed up with just like Otto Hightower basically epitomizing Brian Cox in Succession is like, I love you, but you are not serious people.
Yeah, absolutely. I like your point about Criston hating himself. It's like, have you heard that joke? Like, you're offered $50,000, but if you accept it, the person you hate most in the entire world gets $100,000. And, you know, your response is, of course I would take that. Why wouldn't I want $150,000?
Yeah, surely.
But Criston, he is shocked. He's shocked that he gets this job. And I can think of no one less qualified to do it than him. This is going to go real badly.
Mediocre men like, just failing into power. You know, it's just how it goes. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
He's already bad at his job of Kingsguard.
He can't even do his regular
Lord Commander
job.
Of the Kingsguard. He's losing on that front, like, wildly. And now he's got, like, now he's added the set, like, certainly Hand of the King is... people, some say the most important job in all of Westeros. You know, there was that saying that was repeated in Game of Thrones where the king eats, or no, the king now I'm, of course, I didn't get it. It just fled my brain.
You lost it.
It's like the hand, the hand eats and the king, no, the king eats and the hand wipes. No.
The king shits and the hand wipes?
Yeah, there's shit in there somewhere. But there's like a reverse one where it's better to be the hand. Anyways.
The king eats with the hand feeds him or something like that.
The king eats and the hand takes the shit. The king, or the king shits and the hand wipes.
Yeah.
But that makes it sound not good.
Yeah. Anyways.
Oh, well, yeah, it's a terrible gig, as we know. But it's
famously
a very
worked
poor
out
survival
for
rate.
Sean Bean. Yeah. Yeah.
Very poor survival rate. Hands. Yeah.
And high turnover, even when death isn't involved.
I loved this scene. I think it's the second best scene behind the Rhaenyra and Daemon scene. And there's just so many great beats in it. We called one out earlier, but I just want to call back attention to it because we can be specific here. Is the moment where Aegon says, well, Criston Cole has done something for me. And you just, Otto's face in that moment is like, What do you mean? He's done something.
What do you mean he's done something? Pray tell, sir.
That reaction gif. Yeah. I'm waiting for this episode to come out because that's just a perfect reaction gif. You're just like, what do you mean? And again, it just goes back to everything with like, I really adore the performance of Aegon here because it's just him. I made the joke earlier about Brian Cox, like, you're not serious people, but that's the case where it's just like he's making power plays, but it's all very weak and impotent and just trying to show like surface level strength. And Otto knows how to actually play the game. He is the Brian Cox of like, I know how to do this. Sadly, he is not in the power position that Brian Cox is in Succession. I'm just making Succession equivalents here. But yeah, it's an interesting just back and forth where Otto, you know, I don't really like Otto in terms of like his goals or his desires, but he's undeniably a smart man who is, to his credit, trying to avoid mass death and war. Like he does have some level of understanding of like, you can't just murder civilians. You can't just like, the war has a cost that will cost not just us, but like many people their lives who have nothing to do with this. And so while I don't really agree with his methods or his beliefs, he is trying to avoid all of that. And Aegon, just out of petty petulance and childishness, is just careening headlong into that. And it's a really interesting scene that I think depicts that dynamic very, very well.
Agreed. I like how you're framing it. Like, you know, he has some downsides, but he is trying to avoid mass slaughter and misery for millions of people. And so, you know, that's in the positive category for Otto. And yeah, he is clearly over it. what's interesting, it's like when you get a terrible boss and it's like, oh, remember that boss I used to hate? Like, that guy was so good. Otto literally has that moment. He's like, man, Viserys, that guy was so dignified. And it's like, dude, I remember those guys fighting all the time back in season one, right? Like, they were not, it was not like a harmonious relationship all the time. But sometimes you get such a big downgrade that it causes you to appreciate what you had before. So
I also loved Aegon's response when Otto's like, you wouldn't dare. And he's like, I have dared. And I found amusement in it. Thank you very much. And
that was good. Like, that was really good.
I believe that you are enjoying yourself very much right now, Aegon.
That was a great turn of phrase. Like, I have dared. I love that. I love that. Yeah.
I also really like the moment because it does seem like, remember we called back last episode, there seemed to be a little bit of lamp shading, a bunch of like some criticisms that people had of season one, with like the dragon coming up and not murdering the greens at that point in the penultimate episode, I think, of season one. Here there's another seemingly lampshade moment here where Aegon says, well, Viserys chose me to be king, and Otto just looks back and just like, is that what you think? And it seems like a little bit of a lampshade, which for listeners, as we said last week, lampshading is just like when the writers of a show intentionally just sort of point out like a criticism of the show just to like say like, yeah, we're aware of it, we know it. And I remember a big criticism of season one was just that a lot of Alicent's motivation for like being like, oh, we should actually go against Rhaenyra was on this miscommunication of Viserys on his deathbed, where he says something in like a fever dream, where he thinks it's to Rhaenyra, but it's actually to Alicent. She misinterprets it. So this beat here seems to be Otto realizing that like he seems to be aware that that wasn't what was actually happening in that moment. And I at least appreciate that intelligence on Otto's part and that it's not all just based out of misunderstanding. So I did like that moment of calling that out.
Right, because Otto had all of the plans in place to crown Aegon beforehand, regardless of that final deathbed moment, right?
Mm-hmm. And so it was like, nice, like, oh, yeah, this is definitely legitimizes it, but he was going to do it either way.
Exactly. Yeah.
What a moment too, you know, where he's kind of like, you can imagine, it just, the whole thing just escalates. It's like, hey, it escalates to the point of Otto being like, I made you and I can unmake you. And he loses the stare down, unfortunately. So, yeah. Okay. We have one final scene to discuss. Before we get to it though, Jesse Earl, why don't you let people know where people can find more of your work on the internet this week?
Yes, big thing. If you are listening to this podcast the day, I'm not exactly sure when this will be coming up, but the week that this podcast is going out, my movie Identities, which is a sci-fi thriller film, is being released on Nebula, the streaming service Nebula. It is, like I said, just a quick pitch it. It is a sci-fi thriller film about two people who wake up in a room with no exits and need to discover how to escape, but also have no memory of who they are. And yeah, it's a sort of much longer story. There's a lot more going on than that, but it stars John DeLancey from Star Trek The Next Generation, Abigail Thorne from recently, she was in, as of this recording, the third episode of Star Wars The Acolyte, and she is also going to be in this season of House of the Dragon. It also stars Maggie Mae Fish and a bunch of other folks. This has been a huge project and something that has taken up the last like year and change of my life. And the other thing, just a quick pitch to all of you, is that if enough people watch it, this is hopefully a proof of concept / pilot for a series. So Nebula, the streaming service that funded it, is very much looking at how well it does to see if that's going to be something that does continue. And I would really love that to be the case. So if you are at all interested in anything I just said or want to support me or the work that I do, the only thing I will tell you to do this week is go to nebula.tv/identities, which is IDENTITEAZE. And please sign up for Nebula there. Give the episode a watch. And it would honestly mean the world to me, and also share it about, seriously, this is very much a, you know, we have some marketing, but we're not a big thing. So like the word of mouth really does matter a lot. So thank you for letting me hawk my wares on that. But this is just such a big, this is the biggest moment in my career, and I'm very excited for it. And I hope people love it. So
go watch it.
I'm also very excited for Jesse, and yeah, we'll put a link to that in the show notes so you can be sure to check that out. And I'll plug Kim's book, The Unofficial Guide to Game of Thrones.
Yes, do
it. Thank you. Thank you.
If you enjoy Kim's insights about House of the Dragon, you'll probably enjoy her book about Game of Thrones.
I have it on my shelf.
Oh, wow. Nice. All right. Final scene of the episode. It's Otto and Allison talking because he really doesn't feel like sticking around King's Landing after he was ignominiously disposed of. And they mention that they might try to recruit the assistance of Darren, who is Allison's fourth and final child that she had with Viserys. Have we seen this character before, right?
Nope. And also, I think haven't had any mention of him aside from his little bloodline appearing in the opening credits of season one. So, hey, finally in show confirmation that Alicent and Viserys had a fourth child. He is a boy. His name is Darren, and he has been living in Old Town, which is the Hightower's lands. So
there's also a scene where Alicent finds Aegon crying, but does nothing to comfort him. Instead, she goes to her room and has violent sex with Ser Criston, which, you know,
this fucking guy.
And he was like already there, like waiting for her on the bed. I was like, was this a prearranged?
Yeah, presumptuous much. Jesus.
I am kind of curious where that is going. Clearly, it's not a relationship that is sustainable, but and my guess is it's going to blow up in some pretty painful ways for everyone involved. But I don't know exactly how it's going to do. I assume you both know how it will play out. But for me, I'm like, okay, this is clearly not going anywhere well, not going anywhere good. Also, I am really looking forward to Otto finding out that his daughter is fucking his replacement. Like, that's going to be a good
she
episode.
She tried to tell Daddy him, and he didn't want to hear it.
Yeah, she's like, I have this sin. I must unburden myself. And he's like,
no, thank
you. I don't want to hear it. He's like, Kendall Roy's mom. He's like, let's not talk about it, you know?
We're just making all the succession comparisons. I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I found that really interesting, especially given the whole undoing. Like, the first time Otto was fired as Hand of the King was after he went to Viserys and told him that Rhaenyra and Daemon had been seen doing things that nieces and uncles shouldn't be doing together in King's Landing.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember him being like, it's such a hard thing for a father to hear about, like, the the goings on of his child. And then here, I think, you know, it's like presumably a couple decades later, and we have his daughter trying to be like, Dad, I've been fucking someone I shouldn't. And he's like, nah. Like,
la, 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 la.
Yeah, fingers in ears. Don't want to hear about it. No, thanks. Bye. I'm going to leave now.
I will say one of the things that is difficult for me in the show is Olivia Cooke's age. I don't know if you guys have this experience. Olivia Cooke in real life is 30 years old. Her son, Tom Glyn Carney, Aegon, like, he plays Aegon, right? He is 29 years old.
Oh, boy. Wow.
So
got all of Hollywood.
I just feel like, I just don't, like, Olivia Cooke is crushing. She's awesome in this role. But I just feel like that character feels to me like she should look like 10 years older than she is.
She should at least be like kind of a 40-year-old. Yeah. Yeah.
It's odd to me that they, because I think, what's her name? Who's the person that played Alicent in season one? The young Alicent?
Emily Carey.
Emily Carey. Emily Carey is only 9 years younger than Olivia Cooke. So it was just, it's odd to me that they decided to recast for an actor that was only 9 years older.
Yeah.
Than that actor, you know?
To be fair, I will say, like, Olivia Cooke does just a great, like, it does throw me a little bit, but it doesn't throw me as much, where Olivia Cooke just does play older really well. She just has that bearing of someone who feels much more world-weary, I guess, versus, like, her son who feels much more childish in his performance. So just a credit to both of their acting.
Yeah,
I hear what you're saying.
The performance is really carrying it. Like, it's good enough, but it's just like, sometimes, like, the performance doesn't match what I'm seeing in terms of just their physical appearance sometimes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
agreed.
Anyway, I don't know if anyone else has an issue or if it's just me, but it was a little weird to me because I'm like, oh, Allison feels like she should be older. And because she's had like four kids, right? And I know this is, you know, Westerosi times and stuff, but it's still like, you know, a little odd. So
having those children when she was like 15,
right? So
yeah,
that all times out, I guess.
Also,
still Tom Glenn Carney being 29, though. That's still,
yeah.
Anyway, yeah. All right, go ahead, Jesse.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just wanted to make sure I poked in real quick before we wrapped out. We didn't spend too much time on it, but I at least want to draw attention to it. Missaria. We made mention of it in the sort of like sort of recaps, but her storyline was interesting to me this episode. I again, as a book reader, I'm curious to see what they're doing with that, because she, again, we'll talk maybe more in the bonus episode, but she is slightly different in the book, and I think that the show is trying to angle towards lining that up a little bit more with some of the scenes this episode, between how she's in the book and how she's in the show. And so I found those scenes between her and Rhaenyra to be really interesting, to just kind of, you can see that Rhaenyra kind of sees a little bit of herself in Missaria, and as a woman dealing with patriarchal nonsense. So I thought those scenes were really, really great, even though we haven't really called too much attention to them given the larger plots going on.
All right. Well, we'll have a few more things to talk about in the bonus episode this week, but thank you so much for joining us. Let us know what you thought of the episode at acastofkings@gmail.com. If you want to support this podcast, get the bonus episodes we'll be recording, become a paid subscriber at decodingtv.com. They are Jesse Earl and Kim Renfro. I am David Chen. Thank you so much for listening to A Cast of Kings, a Decoding TV podcast. We'll be back next week with another conversation about a new episode of House of the Dragon. Goodbye.